The Happy Traitor, Spies, Lies and Exile in Russia. The extraordinary story of George Blake is the new book by Simon Cooper. I read an article about him saying that he escaped from prison, fled to Russia, and unlike the posh Cambridge spies, didn't end up a miserable alcoholic. I am, of course, talking about George Blake rather than the author of the book. The book is called The Happy Traitor. It's by Simon Cooper. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, Simon himself. Simon, good morning to you.
Good morning. Hi.
Good to have you with us. Tell us a little bit then about George Blake, because unlike the other of the Cambridge spies, Blake was different.
Yeah, Blake was not completely British. He grew up in the Netherlands, and his father was a Jew from Constantinople who had fought in the French Foreign Legion and also in the British Army in World War One. So that's how he got British citizenship. And George Behar, as he was born in Rotterdam in 1922 and never really lived in Britain until he fled there during World War Two. He arrives there in 1943 for the first time. So he's not completely British. He's not a British gentleman. He's not like Burgess and Filby at all.
And I mean, one of the things is he didn't seem to have any remorse when he was finally captured. And wasn't he famously say that he would, you know, if he met somebody in the same business, he would sit down and have a cup of tea with them. He didn't seem to take it personally. And you could argue that he was almost immoral about the whole situation.
Yeah, he said that if he met the man who betrayed him as a traitor, then he would happily sit down and have a cup of tea with him. I mean, in his view, kind of betraying agents and betraying your own side secrets, well, that was just part of the spying game. You know, his job when he was working for MI6, the British spy service, was to recruit Russians and East Germans to spy against their own countries. And, well, he'd ended up spying against Britain. He'd ended up working for the KGB. But he wasn't immoral. He converted as a genuine believer in communism. He was an idealist, and sort of tragically, his idealism led him onto this very damaging path where about 40 of the agents he betrayed, agents working for Britain, were executed. So really, you know, in effect, he's a mass murderer.
And I mean, if you think about it, I mean, am I correct in thinking that he was a courier for the Dutch underground? And if you think about how dangerous that was and you know, working in, you know, under the noses of the Nazis during the Second World War, you would think that he would know that his actions would end up with, you know, agents being killed, because he'd come across that himself in his teenage years with the underground.
Yeah, I mean, very early on, he starts an underground life. Aged 18, he joins the resistance, and he does travel around the Netherlands passing on documents and underground newspapers. But, you know, he is sort of fearless, and he wants to do something even bigger. And he feels, well, working as a resistance courier is small beer. He really wants to go and get to Britain somehow. He considers, you know, taking a canoe across the North Sea. And he wants to work for the Secret Intelligence Service, which he sees as the kind of organization that orchestrates the world. And then he'll really be doing the big stuff. And this, you know, seems inconceivable. How on earth would you get to Britain during World War II? But he somehow escapes through Belgium and France and into Spain, and from Spain gets on a boat. And, you know, he really does join the Secret Intelligence Service. So he is quite fearless. You know, he converts to communism while in a North Korean prison camp during the Korean War. He's really seen terrible things.
How did he end up, presumably once he got to the UK, he would be the sort of person that the intelligence service would want. I mean, he spoke languages. He'd obviously earned his spurs, if you like, you know, working with the resistance. Presumably he was quite sort of happily recruited by the British intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, it was his ambition to get recruited, but initially he was stuck in the Navy in these kind of mini submarines. But luckily for him, it was found that, you know, he fainted when underwater, which means that you're not really equipped to be in a submarine. And then he is headhunted. You know, a naval officer called Kenneth Cohen tips off the Secret Intelligence Service about Blake. And yeah, I mean, he speaks Dutch, he speaks German, what's not to like? And he's genuinely devoted to the anti-Nazi cause. I mean, the problem really comes when World War II ends and the Nazis are no longer the enemy. And the enemy of British intelligence is the Soviet Union. And Blake's quite sympathetic to the Soviet Union from the start. And that's when he starts to have misgivings about, you know, is he fighting on the right side of the Cold War?
How did he end up in North Korea then, in a North Korean prison camp and get out of it?
Well, I mean, a lot of the book is really about establishment errors. And one is, you know, he was sent to South Korea, which is one of the few countries where he didn't speak the language. He'd actually been sent to Cambridge to learn Russian. He learned Russian very quickly and excellently. And then SIS said, okay, go to South Korea and recruit agents in Vladivostok, sorry, in the Soviet Union. It's not far away. The problem was it was impossible to get to Vladivostok from South Korea, so he couldn't really recruit anyone. And they said to him, wait, because the Korean War is going to break out. And when it does, Britain will remain neutral and you can observe what's happening and send us information. The problem was that when the Korean War did break out in 1950, Britain didn't remain neutral. It went into the war as a kind of American sidekick. And that's when Blake becomes very, you know, disillusioned with the British Empire. He realizes now we're just an American sidekick. What am I here for? The Americans are doing terrible damage, you know, bombing these innocent Korean villagers. And he decides there that he's fighting on the wrong side of the Korean War. So he's really sent to Korea by error, I would say.
And I mean, you mentioned Cambridge, and obviously that was a fertile recruiting ground for the Soviet Union. Blake's a little bit different, even though he has been there studying Russian. We can look now at what the Cambridge set did, but they were sort of seduced, weren't they, by the utopia that they thought the Soviet Union was.
And so was Blake. But the Cambridge Five, the five men recruited in the 1930s, Kim Philby, Guy Burgess, Donald MacLean, John Carecross, and Anthony Blunt, are different. I mean, they're posh, most of them, not Carecross, but most of them are posh British undergraduates. They see fascism, understandably, as the terrible enemy of the 1930s. And they feel that the British government is letting the fascists do what they like, that only the communists really stand up to the fascists. This comes to a head in the Spanish Civil War when Britain and France don't really support the Spanish Republic. And so these men decide, well, communism is the future. Communism is going to fight fascism. Now, in the 30s, that's an understandable mistake to make. By 1950, when Blake converts, we know really about the terrible communist crimes, about the Gulag, about the millions who die under Stalin. And Blake kind of, who's a peaceful man at heart, he pushes that to the back of his mind and decides that communism is the ideal he wants to die for.
And so how did he make contact with the Soviet intelligence? And it wouldn't, what was the actual agency he made contact with over the Iron Curtain?
Well, the North Koreans take him and other British and French diplomats and journalists captive. And after a horrible death march where he sees hundreds of people die, he and seven other men, British, French, highly educated, intelligent men, are sitting around doing nothing when a presence arrives from the Soviet embassy, these three books, Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson, which they all read to pieces, and two books in Russian by Marx and Lenin, Marx's Capital translated into Russian. Blake reads it twice, becomes convinced that communism is the way to go, and he hands a note in Russian to the North Korean camp guard to hand on to the Soviet embassy. And then a KGB agent called Nikolai Loenko shows up in camp and interrogates Blake and the other prisoners, just so that Blake doesn't look suspicious, and then decides that Blake is a genuine article and recruits him to the KGB.
And so presumably they sent him back to the UK to start sending information back. Were the British Secret Service just relieved to have their man back as they saw it?
Yeah, I mean, when Stalin died in 1953, the Korean War swiftly sort of ends and the prisoners are sent home. And Blake and other British prisoners arrive in Britain to this hero's welcome. You know, there's a BBC interviewer as they step off the plane. And the Secret Intelligence Service should have known better, because this is just 2 years after Burgess and MacLean had defected to the Soviet Union. But they don't for a moment suspect that Blake might have been turned in captivity. They thought, well, the North Koreans are too primitive to do anything like that. And so, you know, it's very much, welcome back, George, jolly good to see you. He's sent on holiday. And then a few months later, he just starts work again at SIS in London. But now he has a camera in his back pocket, a mini camera, and he's photographing documents and handing them to his KGB handlers all the time.
And these were the names of British agents, which is basically, I suppose, a death sentence for anybody working behind the Iron Curtain. You're at the height of the Cold War. It is even before the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, that sort of information must have been manna from heaven for the Soviets and anybody behind the Iron Curtain.
Yeah, I mean, he estimates that he gave about 500 agents' names to his handlers. Now, after Stalin's death, the communists were less bloodthirsty than before. So, as I say, only in quotation marks, about 40 of these people are reckoned to have been killed. But, you know, hundreds more spent time in jail, had their lives ruined by Blake. And it's something that, you know, because he is quite a peace, he was a peace-loving man. You know, when I interviewed him about it in 2012, he kind of was living in denial. You know, he stuck to his story that nothing bad had been done to these people. He told the KGB they weren't allowed to hurt these people. And I'm sure he did tell the KGB that. But of course, the KGB ignored it. As you say, this was the Cold War and brutal things were done. And Blake was naive, but not so naive as not to understand that.
What was the, because he was caught, he was imprisoned, and we'll come onto that in a minute, but what was the, when did the British security start to think that they had a man who was handing, they had a mole, they had a man who was handing stuff over, because they thought they got rid of all their moles with, you know, as we said, the, you know, Burgess and Philby and the rest of them?
Well, around 1960, they realized that some British documents are popping up behind the Iron Curtain in spy services there. And there are about 10 suspects, one of whom is Blake. And then this Polish colonel with an intelligence officer with a handlebar moustache called Michał Goloniewski defects to the West beginning of 61. And he gives enough information that it becomes clear that the mole is Blake. And there's another double agent in Berlin. There's, you know, huge amounts of double agents in Berlin who also points the finger of suspicion at Blake. Blake, by this point, had been sent to Lebanon to learn Arabic, you know, as part of his SIS work. And so SIS had this problem, how to get him back from Lebanon to London to be interrogated without arousing his suspicion, because he might have done a runner through Syria into the Soviet Union. So they say to him, oh, George, you know, come back, considering you for promotion. And of course, he smells a rat, but he thinks, what can I do? He doesn't want to tell his wife, who's a very conservative British type, who would not be happy to hear that her husband is a KGB agent. And so he thinks, well, maybe nothing's up. So he flies back to London, hoping that they don't suspect him. And of course, you know, I said to him, what did you feel when you arrived at St. James's at the office there? And he said, I felt the game is up. They realized that he was an agent and they walked him across the park very amicably to Cadogan Place to be interrogated.
And he was given the longest the sentence for espionage ever to have been handed by a British court. And that would seemingly be that. But of course, he was sprung, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was supposed to be in jail for 42 years, which is an amazingly long sentence, considered so at the time. But, you know, from the second he arrives in jail, where he's very popular among the other prisoners, you know, he teaches them French and Arabic and German, and he writes letters to the authorities on their behalf. He's kind of the most popular man in prison. And from the second he arrives there, he's looking for people who can help him escape. And he eventually finds these three guys, prisoners who are then released, Sean Burke, an Irishman, and these two British peace activists, Pat Pottle and Michael Randall, and they agree to help him escape. And so they, in 1966, you know, Burke throws a rope ladder over the wall of the prison and Blake jumps down and is free. I mean, it must be said it was quite easy to escape from British jails in the 1960s. Lots of people did, including two of the great train robbers.
And he, from there, he makes his way into Moscow and into folklore. Am I correct? Were there George Blake is innocent graffiti? Was that a thing?
Were there George Blake? Sorry,
wasn't George Blake is innocent a thing? Wasn't there that scrawled on walls? I seem to remember.
It may have been. I mean, there were all sorts of conspiracy theories going around, one of which was that MI6 had helped him escape, which wasn't the case, or that the KGB had done it, which wasn't the case either. It really was just this bunch of mates. It was quite amateurish. I mean, it was like something out of a cartoon book. And so nobody knew what had happened. And people were speculating about, you know, he's in Moscow, he's in South America, he's in Ireland. And in fact, he spent 2 months sitting in a flat in Hampstead belonging to one of the peace activists before they managed to convert a camper van. And peace activists and his wife and sons went on a supposed family holiday to West Berlin with Blake hiding in a secret compartment at the bottom of the van. And quite easily, you know, they got out from Calais, from Dover to Calais to Berlin, no problems.
And so when he got to Russia, now a lot of you know, it seems to be a regular story, you know, you hear about the Cambridge set being wretchedly unhappy, living in small apartments in Moscow, being because they were of no use anymore and basically forgotten and turning to sort of drink and melancholy. But for Blake, it wasn't like that.
No, I mean, what you're describing is the story of Kim Philby and Guy Burgess. Burgess drank himself to death. Philby got pretty close to doing so. And you know, they felt they were in exile. Burgess said that the Soviet Union was like Glasgow on a Saturday night in the 19th century, which is a great phrase. But Blake, you know, he was multilingual. He's a cosmopolitan. He'd grown up between Rotterdam and Cairo, where he'd spent a few years at school. And he was able to adapt anyway. He's a very positive-minded man. And he just thought, I'm going to make a go of this. I mean, he realized, like all the others, one of the big shocks they had was that within a week of arriving in Moscow, you realize communism doesn't work. This is a disaster. I've given my life for a mirage and left my family behind, in Blake's case, you know, wife and three young sons whom he adored. And, you know, you'd think, what do you do after that disillusionment? But Blake just kind of plugged on. He married a Russian woman, had a son, and he ended up working for Donald Maclean's think tank. Donald Maclean was the one of the Cambridge Five who ended up living happily in the Soviet Union, really made a life for himself, learned Russian, and he and Blake became soulmates.
Interesting. And you interviewed Blake. What was it like interviewing? I mean, obviously you knew about him, and how did you find him?
Well, I grew up in the Netherlands like Blake, and I had a Dutch friend in Moscow who's a friend of Blake's, and he agreed to set me up with an interview with Blake. But first, Blake wanted to interview me. So when I visited Moscow in 2012, Blake called me on my phone and he asked me, you know, about myself and what I was planning to do. And I said, look, I'm just going to write one article for a Dutch newspaper, which was my plan at the time. And he was quite happy about that. He wanted to speak to the old homeland. He'd been away for 70 years at that point. And so he invited me to his dacha. So I arrive and there's this little man with a cane, you know, nearly 90, very charming old bloke. He asks if we can speak Dutch because he doesn't get much chance to speak Dutch in Moscow, he says. And we spend 3 hours sitting together and he's able to reflect on his life. He's very intelligent and thoughtful and funny even. And I was quite charmed, I must admit. I mean, I knew about his life. I'd read a couple of books, including his own. But I emerged from the interview quite charmed and planning just to write it for a Dutch magazine newspaper. And when I got back home, I live in Paris, my wife said, but you were charmed by this bloke who's a serial killer. You know, from what you say, he sent 40 people to their deaths. So a couple of years later, you know, this interview didn't leave my mind. I thought, this is the most interesting interview I've ever done. I've got to turn it into a book. And that's where I began researching his life. And I achieved much more distance from him than I had when I was sitting next to him. And I hope I've written a fairly even-handed book. But yeah, I mean, I liked him.
You also got access to the Stasi records, the feared East German secret police. How illuminating was that?
Well, that was great because, I mean, when you're writing about espionage, you know, almost everything is secret and stays secret. So MI6 have never released their file on Blake. It's just too embarrassing for them. The KGB archives are very briefly open in the 90s, then closed. And the Stasi archive is just a treasure, you know, treasure trove, because this is a state, East Germany, that went defunct. And so everything from its intelligence agency has just been put online, you know, with people's names rubbed out in many cases to, you know, save their privacy. But yeah, with Blake, it was all completely open. I read whatever I wanted. And beautifully, he'd given four long talks to the Stasi in the late 70s and 1980, which they had videoed and recorded. And so I was able to see exactly, you know, him perform there and talk about his life and what he said once, you know, he was able to speak much more freely than before. So that was just a fantastic source of information.
I mean, if by the sounds of it, I mean, look, going through what he said and his, you know, the way he adapted chameleon-like to his new surroundings. I mean, he really was a practitioner of real politics in its strongest sense. I mean, he was, you know, he'd had the Dutch, he was with the Dutch, he was with the British, and he finally ended up seemingly quite content in Moscow.
Yeah, he was sort of a man without a homeland by the end, but he'd always been a man of ideals. So he'd grown up a very devout Calvinist, and then he became a very devout communist. And by the time I met him, his ideals were kind of fading, and he had just managed to find at last just happiness with family. He'd reconnected with his British sons, who began visiting him in the 80s and stayed close to him the rest of his life. And he sort of had given up on beliefs. I mean, the thing he was anxious about in the interview was that I would ask him about Putin, because he detested Putin. He thought it was a kind of cynical, horrible KGB regime. But he didn't want to talk about that because, you know, he got his dacha and his pension from Putin. And yeah, so he'd kind of retreated into private life. But, you know, he was a kind of tragedy of idealism. He was like the modern jihadis of our time. He had really fallen for this ideal that promised paradise on earth, and he was willing to kill in its service.
But if you think about it, I mean, you mentioned it earlier on, Spanish Civil War, the ideology of that and the International Brigades, and I'm sitting in a studio in Spain, so we know a bit about that. The thing of the Second World War, again, those two, you know, the Nazism against democracy, against communism, and then that whole belief in the Soviet Union. So he really does reflect his time. What do you hope that people will take from your book?
I mean, for a start, you know, the man's life is a Netflix series. You know, he was everywhere. He lived through World War II and the Cold War in its most dramatic moments. So it really is like a real life, I think, spy story. And, you know, if there's a message, I think don't be an idealist. You know, go for the least bad society in history, which essentially is the society where Blake and I grew up, the Netherlands. You know, it's not paradise. It's not an ideal, but it's pretty good. And Blake was one of these people who needed an ideal, and those people are very dangerous.
And the title, The Happy Traitor, I mean, you absolutely nailed it with that one then, Simon.
Well, he asked me at the end of our conversation, he said, well, you've heard my story now. What do you think of me? And I said, well, I'm surprised because I'd expected to find a more tragic person. And he burst out laughing. He said, no, tragic I am not. And I said, yeah, you're quite an amiable bloke. And he said, yes, I'm a happy man. And people will say I don't deserve to be happy, but I am very happy. And so hence the title, The Happy Traitor.
The book is called The Happy Traitor. It's out now. It's by Simon Cooper. Simon, if people want to find you, do you have a website? Is there internet? How can they get in contact with you?
I've created a website, thehappytraitor.com, and I'm also on Twitter as Cooper Simon, Kuper Simon. So either way, I'd be very happy to hear from people about the book.
The book is called The Happy Traitor. I can't wait to get my hands on a copy. I'll be able to download it from the virtual bookstore. Simon Cooper, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.